Welcome to the Deep End by On Deck, a podcast where visionary builders, creators, and experts discuss world-changing ideas. I'm your host, Marshall Kosloff. Let's dive in.
So something we say a lot is emotional fitness is an individual journey, but a communal pursuit. So if you think about going to the gym, no one can lift your weights for you. You have to lift them yourself. But it's a hell of a lot easier to do that when there are other people around who are also lifting weights, and there's someone to spot you, and there's someone who's farther along who can give you tips, and someone who's newer who can make you feel like, oh, what I'm doing is working. And that's what we're trying to create with mental health. Like, ultimately, you still have to do the hard work on yourself. But when you're supported by other people who are also doing the work and can reflect things back to you and are on the journey with you, it just makes a big difference.
At the Deep End, we're creating a space where we skip the surface level and go in depth into ideas that inspire people to build. I'll be your guide as we explore possible futures of internet communities, creator tools, climate tech, longevity, and much, much more. There are no experts in uncharted territory, only pioneers. The Deep End invites these trailblazers to turn their experiences into the knowledge and ideas that others need to start their own founder odyssey. Joining me this week in the Deep End is Dr. Emily Anhalt. Dr. Anhalt is a psychologist, emotional fitness consultant, and the co-founder and chief medical officer of COA, which describes itself as building a gym for your mental health. Today's conversation is about how to train for emotional fitness. Just like trainers at a traditional gym might rotate clients between leg day, chest day, and shoulder day, Dr. Anhalt and her colleagues have developed classes to train different traits of emotional fitness, like resilience, empathy, and self-awareness. Working on yourself is a deeply personal endeavor, but Dr. Anhalt stresses the value of having a community that encourages you along your emotional fitness journey. Nobody can lift your weights for you, but you can benefit from having metaphorical spotters to help keep you safe and encourage you as you work out. In addition to discussing what exactly goes into performing the equivalent of an emotional push-up, we dive into how the pandemic has influenced the mental health landscape, analyze the stigma around seeking help, and compare and contrast in-person therapy with virtual options. For the past 12 years, Dr. Anhalt has been working clinically with executives, founders, and tech employees, and has conducted extensive research with prominent psychologists and entrepreneurs about how leaders can improve their emotional fitness. She and Koa are also partnered with On Deck Health. She draws on that deep experience repeatedly throughout our time together. Dr. Emily Anhalt, welcome to the Deep End.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is an exciting episode, not only because you come from a great background and the topic we're going to cover, COA, mental health, a gym for mental fitness, is incredibly useful. It's also deeply interesting. So half of these questions are just things I've wanted to ask a professional slash founder like yourself. So I'm excited to get into things. Let's just start with the most obvious question by setting the stage. A year and a half plus into COVID, how would you... Oh, this is fun. I'll ask this on two different levels. So firstly, as an actual mental health professional, how would you assess the state of mental health in America and broader parts of the world who use these type of services? And then the second part will be as a founder who's looking at a space where you're building a company in. So let's start with the professional answer first.
Well, Marshall, it's not the best. I would not say most people are living their best lives right now. Understandably, we've all been through this kind of collective trauma together. And, you know, it's interesting to go through it with all of mankind, that's for sure. I can tell you that I, as a therapist, was not trained in grad school to support people through a global pandemic that I myself am experiencing at the same time. So that's been a really interesting one for clinicians everywhere, how to support others and ourselves in similar ways at the same time. And at the same time, it's been pretty amazing to see the resilience and the way that this has shifted the narrative of mental health in the eyes of a lot of people. It's almost like people feel permission or necessity or something in a new way to work on their mental and emotional health. So that's a positive thing. You know, I read a study, I talk about this a lot, but I read a study years ago about prisoners of war who had been captured and tortured, and specifically was looking at what dreams they were having. And while they were captured, they were having all of these beautiful dreams about cake and their spouses and home and all of these lovely things. But then when they were released and went home and were safe, they suddenly started having these horrible nightmares about torture and pain and, you know, all of the awful things. And the whole point of this article is to show that it's often not until we're through or past a trauma that we can fully allow ourselves to feel the consequences of it. And that's something I'm seeing right now, is I actually am seeing a lot of people are doing worse now than they were doing in the worst part of the pandemic, because, you know, there's some hope, there's some clarity. It's still a lot of unknowns, obviously, but there's almost some safety and space to realize how tough this has been. So I'm feeling that. On the professional side of things, it's an interesting and important time to be in mental health. You know, demand for our services went up 900% from corporate partners when the pandemic first hit. And what's been really cool, though, is to see that there are people who might never have considered themselves as someone who needs this kind of support, who are testing it out and realizing, oh, you know, nothing actually has to be wrong with me to work on my mental and emotional health. And that's been a really lovely thing to see.
Yeah, so that's a helpful pivot to just what COA actually does and how you conceive of it and just conceptualize it. So what would your, I don't want to say elevator pitch because that makes it seem too constrained. Just what are your expansive thoughts on what you're building and why it really appeals to people?
So COA is a gym for mental health. The main mission of COA is to make working on your mental and emotional health as common and accessible and proactive as working on your physical fitness is. Now, our goal is 10 years from now, saying that you're going to an emotional fitness class is as common as saying that you're going to a yoga class. And the reason we think this is so important is that right now, the landscape of mental health is very reactive. People tend to think that they have to wait until things are falling apart to work on themselves. But as I say, that's a little like waiting until you have early signs of heart disease to do cardio. So we really want to shift this narrative of mental health to being a more proactive thing that we work on to prevent mental health struggles, because they tend to be easier to prevent than to fix. So at COA, we do therapy matchmaking right now in California and New York. And then we do therapist-led emotional fitness classes. So in these classes, we've essentially figured out what is an emotional push-up and how do you do one? How do you work on your emotional health in an ongoing way? And the curriculum is based on research that I did about a decade ago, where I interviewed 100 psychologists and 100 entrepreneurs. And I asked them, how would you know if you were sitting across the table from an emotionally healthy person? What does that look like? What does that feel like? What do they do? What do they not do? And out of this research came these 7 traits of emotional fitness, the 7 things that emotionally healthy people are always working on. And those 7 things are self-awareness, empathy, curiosity, mindfulness, playfulness, resilience, and communication. And so in our classes, you're learning how to work on those 7 things, and you're doing so in community, live, with a licensed clinician facilitating. It's super engaging and experiential, and it's been really amazing to see how it's landing with people.
I'm glad you gave the expansive answer, because I have a million different questions that come from that in no particular order. The use of the word community is very interesting, because I think if we think of the pop culture driven image of therapy, it's you and the psychiatrist or a psychologist on the couch, and it's by yourself and it's private. Talk about the community aspect and how that's key to how you're conceptualizing the value add here.
Yeah. So something we say a lot is emotional fitness is an individual journey, but a communal pursuit. So if you think about going to the gym, no one can lift your weights for you. You have to lift them yourself. But it's a hell of a lot easier to do that when there are other people around who are also lifting weights, and there's someone to spot you, and there's someone who's farther along who can give you tips, and someone who's newer who can make you feel like, oh, what I'm doing is working. And that's what we're trying to create with mental health. Like, ultimately, you still have to do the hard work on yourself. But when you're supported by other people who are also doing the work and can reflect things back to you and are on the journey with you, it just makes a big difference. So yeah, there is still that one-on-one therapy for sure. But then being able to go to a class and practice the things you're learning with other people and talk about them and hear other people going through the same thing as you and what's been working for them, it just takes it to a totally different level. You know, we're kind of suffering from a different epidemic right now, which is loneliness. You know, digital communication has made us more connected than ever, but also lonelier than ever in a lot of ways, because it's not always a very nourishing kind of connection. And so by building community back in, we are healing ourselves as we heal ourselves.
Let's go on a quick tangent into loneliness, because that's an interesting area where we all know the conventional wisdom phrasing around COVID. All it did was advance trends that already existed. It didn't fundamentally create anything new. So there was already this slightly bubbling discourse that a lot of people in the communities that you're really working with already were starting to feel disconnected and lonely. And just COVID just 10x'd that. So can you just broadly speak about what people refer to as the epidemic of loneliness during this 2010s period, even outside of the very obvious COVID context?
I mean, I think technology has a lot to do with it. What's been interesting as we've replaced so many of our relationships with technology is we have this illusion of being really connected to each other, but it doesn't always translate into that actual, you know, feeling of comfort and togetherness. I liken it a little bit to fast food. You know, so if you're at home by yourself and you can text with a friend, that's certainly better than nothing. It's certainly better than going hungry, right? Eating fast food's better than starving. But if all you ever do is connect with people through text, if all you ever do is click likes on social media and, you know, interact people in that kind of way, I think it's the same thing as only ever eating fast food. Over time, you don't actually feel healthy. You don't feel nourished. It's filling, but it's not nourishing. That's what I think a little bit about all of the technology we're using. And so I just hear a lot of people saying, you know, yeah, I'm online talking to people all day, but at the end of the day, I don't actually feel like I've truly been seen and truly connected to anyone. So there's just something very powerful about being in an actual room with other humans and feeling their presence, you know, and knowing that you're not alone. So I think that's a really big part of it.
Let's keep playing with the gym and fitness metaphor then. Obviously, if you are working out, it's cool to focus on your muscles, but everyone knows that 80% of it's actually going to be the nutrition aspect. How you could go to the, you know, Equinox 7 days a week, but if you eat McDonald's all the time, it doesn't really make that much of a difference when it comes to a six pack. So what do you think is the nutritional aspect of this mental health journey you're really talking about? So like, you know, you're doing your COA classes, you're attending your therapy. What are the broader building blocks that you need to actually be fueling yourself or thinking about when you're approaching this process?
What a cool question. I'd say the broader, I mean, in our classes and in therapy, you are learning and practicing how to lean toward discomfort instead of away from it. Like if I were to sum up any kind of self-growth in a few words, it would be becoming more comfortable being uncomfortable. We're so good at hiding things from ourselves. We're so good at turning away from things that are painful. But in all of that turning away, we actually end up with a lot worse of issues. So I'd say the building block, the thing that makes it all go around, is a willingness to lean into discomfort, to turn toward your suffering and pain, to allow yourself to feel those things, because that's how we move through them. You know, I think there's this hope and wish and idea that if you just pretend everything's fine and think positive and push ahead, that it'll be okay. But that's, in my experience, the opposite of what's true. You actually have to feel your feelings. You have to, you know, grieve your losses. And that's how you move forward towards something better.
And this is the part which, and you've gotten this a bit, but I want to put it explicitly. If we're thinking of this process as, or COA as, you know, a gym for mental fitness, what are the parts of the gym, right? So like, what's the equivalent of the rowing machine or the treadmill, the personal trainer? Maybe the metaphor could be pushed too hard, but I think as we're all trying to come up with something coherent here as we're moving forward, there's a reason why metaphors mean something, to give a framework or a way of thinking about things. So how should we just think about whether you're using COA or not, all of these building blocks together?
So there's everything you do in the gym, and there are things you do out of the gym. Similarly, all the things you do in therapy in these classes and the things you do out of them. But when you're in the gym, there's leg day and arm day, there's the rowing machine, there's the treadmill. And our equivalent of that is these seven traits. These are seven different aspects of who you are in the world that need your attention and focus and that need you to be doing hard work on them. So self-awareness is very different than curiosity, for example. They affect each other, just like at the gym. If you have better cardio, you're going to be able to go harder with your muscle training and vice versa. All of these seven weave into each other, but they ask slightly different things of you. And so I'd say people get to tap into these different facets of who they are in relation to themselves and other people by exploring these seven traits.
So something I'm wondering about is the underlying model here. So for example, when you do the on-deck healthcare fellowship, you get access to COA services. So that's, you know, in cooperation between COA and OnDeck and the fellows. How does that just broadly work? Like, so are customers employers? Is it individuals? How does that part work?
There are a couple different ways that we partner with different organizations. Our big goal is just to support as many people as possible with working on their emotional fitness. And there's so much aligned with OnDeck because it's a community-driven approach to better leadership. And our belief is that real emotional fitness and change has to start with leaders, whether you're the leader of a company or you're a parent, or if you're in any kind of position where you have influence over other people. It's really important that you do your work first, because that trickles down and people are going to look to you to think about whether they have permission to do their work on themselves and to have that kind of support. And so having this opportunity to partner with OnDeck means that we get to support leaders so that they can support themselves, so that they can support the people working with them and the companies, the products they're making, and the people using their products. In terms of more broadly, we partner in different ways. Some companies bring us in and we do our classes specifically for their teams. Other companies subsidize or sponsor their communities to take our classes on their own schedule at different times. So it can look like a lot of different things, but there's just something very powerful about having a shared language with a group of other humans about how to be more vulnerable and move closer to each other.
Yeah, I think the space that you're in is just blowing up so quickly that we don't often take a step back and think about how momentous it is, that this is as obvious as this is. So for example, I'm curious, going to your professional background, when you were talking to founders and entrepreneurs 10 years ago, how, I assume people were not as open or interested in this topic to this, to a certain degree. I'm curious how you've seen this evolve. Once again, like obviously there's this 900, you know, percent COVID increase. But I'm guessing even in the period before then, there's a reason why you got started when you did. There was an increasing openness to it. So can you just talk about, on a professional level, how you saw that space changing?
Oh, for sure. I do feel like I was, you know, at the crest of the wave right around this recent time. But beforehand, everything that you pointed at was happening, for sure. I had an idea when I had gotten licensed and I'd been working with founders and VCs and entrepreneurs for many years already. And I was seeing that there were all of these issues in people's companies that were very mirrored to the things that I was learning about in general. You know, that it was so clear that a lot of things happen at work that are really about our own stuff that we are leaking onto the people around us, and that there's this really wonderful opportunity to really affect the bottom line by confronting these things and supporting people. And it was becoming more clear to me that mentally and emotionally healthy people at work were going to do better work, period. And so I went out there and I started pitching this idea of, you know, how about I come in and I help with the mental and emotional health of the people you're working with, your portfolio companies. And there were certainly plenty of people who were like, that's not my job, or that's not important, or that's not really worth investing, or I don't want to make it messy. I'm not this person's therapist. There were all kinds of objections. And over the past handful of years, it's been really amazing to see people be like, oh, okay, maybe this is important for me to take a look at. Maybe I do play a role in ensuring that my founders have the support they need. Maybe that will get me where I'm wanting to go better. And so, yeah, it kind of just exploded out the gate. And I think COVID had a lot to do with it. But before that, what had a lot to do with it was people with platforms starting to speak up. Mm-hmm. So people ask me a lot, how do I get my friend, partner, colleague, whatever, into therapy? And my answer is always, you can't force anyone else into therapy, but you could get yourself into therapy and then speak transparently and openly about the difference it's making in your life and how profound it's been for you. And that is what will get other people on board. Like, I've matched, I think, something like 600 people personally into therapy at this point. And it's never from me talking about myself as a therapist. It's always from me talking about myself as a patient and why therapy has been profound for me. And so in the past couple of years, there have been figures who have spoken more openly about mental health and therapy and meditation and all kinds of things that they're doing to take care of themselves. And it's given this more broad permission to society, essentially, to start looking at these things and to think about them.
Something I'm wondering about, especially when you're talking to founders, VCs, organizations, is that there is a possible tension that I'm sure exists between, what is the balance between hey, like, go to therapy, learn to handle your shit. Not even that was sort of pejorative, but just like, you know, between taking responsibility, going to therapy, or just the fact that, hey, like, you actually just work for a toxic place where the structure here is like very badly set up. I, cause something I just wonder a lot about is there's lots of like interesting frank conversations, especially on Twitter, because once again, people are being more franker and open now about, hey, like, does working 24/7 actually lead to good outcomes? Is that a structure that makes sense? I could see a workplace where having people engage in mental fitness doesn't deal with the underlying fact that there is something that's structurally been set up poorly. So can you just speak to that tension between like the individual and their own mental fitness process and just like structural problems or processes that they could be stuck in the middle of?
Yeah, this is such an important topic. And what's interesting is that we all talk about this as though it's two different things, as though the answer is either I need to work on myself or the structures I'm a part of are problematic, when actually they're very interwoven. You know, if you think about a person who's in a toxic relationship, for example, a lot of what's going on there is not their fault. And the answer might be you're in the wrong relationship, get out of it. But what isn't addressed often enough is that we don't find ourselves in particular relationships by accident. We bring our own set of struggles and biases and complicated needs and things that are painful, you know, trauma, all of that to each of our relationships. And so we are attracted to certain environments and certain systems based on our own backgrounds. And so as we work on ourselves, it becomes easier to distinguish, is this something that's just mine, or is this something that I was drawn to, or is this something that I'm stuck in? The other thing is these problematic, unhealthy systems were built by individuals who need to do their own work. So if we want to dismantle oppressive and problematic systems, it is going to take a lot of individual work. And that's part of why I like to focus on leaders, because the people with power are the ones who most need to be working on themselves, because they're the ones making decisions that end up creating these structures that everyone's a part of. So to me, it's a both and situation. We all need to be thinking about what we are bringing to our situation, what agency we play in our own lives. And we need to be thinking about how the collective problems can turn into structures that leave people feeling really trapped and stuck.
Something I'm curious about is just this broad, and I'll be very delicate when I say this, because it's just something that I kind of get it, but I don't get it. Could you talk about the stigma around taking your mental health seriously? Because there's usually kind of a contradiction here in the sense that there's never been more money in the mental health space in terms of like at a startup healthcare investment level. You have athletes like Kevin Love of the NBA talking about this. So, and especially in certain, I don't want to say fashionable, like this is just like a quote unquote lifestyle choice, but it's actually very, especially in the startup community, be very frank about people going through these types of processes. It seems like we have to a certain degree turned the corner around stigma around mental health. It's not the 50s or 60s anymore. That's just my own personal perception, but I would love to hear your just articulation of like where I'm kind of mischaracterizing it, where there actually is stigma. Maybe Twitter isn't real life and I shouldn't just take the fact that people with blue checks and who are cool can talk about it. I just love to hear how you think about this dynamic.
I think both are a little bit true. Yes, I think we've come a really long way. Like the fact that people can say, oh, I have therapy, you know, I can't make it that day, and that isn't a fireable offense anymore. I mean, we've made progress, you know, but we're a really, really long way from where we need to go. Mm-hmm. There is still so much stigma. And there's two aspects of the stigma that are interesting to me. There's the cultural stigma. There's the, you know, feeling that we're going to be judged or discriminated against or misunderstood by others. But there's also a really, really deep and complicated internal stigma. And that goes beyond just, oh, you know, it's not okay in society, so it's not okay with me. I'd go so far as to say that it's really that we all have a lot of fear of dependence. We all are scared about needing someone else to be okay. I think we all want it to be able to do everything and, you know, get anywhere we need to go on our own. And it's complicated to realize, no, I need other people and I need support and I need help. So we're fighting both of those kinds of stigmas. And I'd say we have quite a long way to go, you know, until going to an emotional fitness class or therapy is as unremarkable as going to the gym or a yoga class, then I'd say we're nowhere near the finish line.
Yeah, the point about fireable offense is really helpful because, once again, we've only, when I think of stigma around mental health issues, I think of, you know, the first season of Mad Men, where Betty Draper going to going to a therapist was this whole season defining plot point.
Yeah.
But in our actual lived experiences, because these things were quiet and, once again, could have been, you know, fireable offenses, I don't actually know the not, you know, AMC real life version of this. So could you actually talk about the evolution of workplaces and acceptance around these issues beyond just, once again, pop culture references?
It's such a complicated thing to talk about because it's run the gamut for a long time. I mean, there have been safe places to work on yourself, and there have been places where you can't say anything about that. You know, I have ADHD, and my feeling about my ADHD is that it's actually more of a superpower than a disorder. But it's taken me a long time to get there. And along the way, I had to do a lot of understanding about how to talk about it with employers and people I was working with, such that I could get the, you know, accommodations that I need to do my best work without it seeming like I, you know, don't know what I'm doing, or I'm not going to be able to do what I need to do, that kind of thing. And I'd say in the spectrum of mental health things, ADHD is not one of the more stigmatized ones. I mean, you know, there's stigma, but compared to like struggling with bipolar disorder or major depressive disorder, that kind of thing. So I can speak from my experience, which is, gosh, I mean, I don't even know where to start the history of it. There's so much there. And even saying, oh, we've come so far now, I think does speak a little bit to the privilege of living in the tech bubble, where people are talking about these things and where, you know, there is permission there. But if you speak to someone who lives, you know, in other parts of the country and in other industries, they actually might not feel like much has changed at all. It's hard to say.
Without getting too deep on it, could you actually talk about, I'm glad you referenced the tech bubble, because this is also something I've noticed, once again, me just like referencing Twitter, like I really am seeing friends, colleagues, et cetera, who work in a tech industry where these conversations are very much in vogue, being just very comfortable with sharing very openly and publicly, I'm going into therapy, I have a coach, I have X, Y, or Z problem. Is that within a bubble, or is that, and because once again, like there, this isn't even just a whole, you know, education gap question. Like I don't see my friends who work on Wall Street having the same amount of openness and acceptance around this. So could you talk about like the bubbled aspect and how much of this is all pervading versus not?
So I think about two aspects. First of all, you know, tech is about sort of being ahead of the curve. There's something new that wasn't there before. It's likely that the tech world is going to experience it first. You know, I think about how crypto, for example, was adopted much earlier by the tech crowd. And maybe just now some people who aren't super into tech are starting to hear about it and think about it and, you know, lean into it. So there is a way in which I think Silicon Valley and the tech scene has been early adopters of the mental health movement. There's certainly that aspect, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that there's another aspect, which is privilege. That if you are an affluent person with a platform on Twitter and you are in a position of not getting fired for things, or, you know, knowing that you're going to be okay no matter what, you're going to feel safer to speak about stigmatized things versus someone who, you know, worries about the consequences and who is at the mercy of other people's authority and decision-making around whether they can make the money they need to live their life. So I think both of those things are true and not unrelated. Obviously, if you have privilege, you can early adopt things more easily because there are fewer consequences. But I think both of those things are happening. What's cool about it, though, is it is spreading. You know, we are seeing more and more people look to that and be like, okay, well, if Kevin Love does therapy, like I could do therapy. And that has been really amazing to see. People who 10 years ago would never even consider doing this work are now feeling like they have the permission to do so. And it also means that resources are going to be hopefully more readily available.
Speaking of athletes, I'm rewatching ESPN's The Last Dance on Netflix right now. And for listeners who aren't paying attention to the cultural zeitgeist of 2020, that's the Michael Jordan 10-part documentary that's really, really incredible. Of the last season he was with the Bulls. And just seeing the way that Kevin Love is talking about not only like his involvement with Koa, but just like the need and the vulnerability, it seems like there's this total culture shift, specifically in sports and athletics. Because like, once again, I think we can overdo it with the tech founders and operators as athletes metaphors, because there just is like a difference there. There is a difference in literal performance expected of athletes. So could you speak about how athletes themselves are redefining their relationship with mental health that we're seeing just very visibly in the space?
Well, I'll tell you, I am far from an athlete, so I can only speak to, you know, the sort of proximity that I've gotten to experience based on, you know, Kevin Love coming on as an investor and dipping into that world a little bit. And we've collaborated with amazing organizations like the NBA, things like that. If I were to guess, and, you know, I'm sure there's someone who's much more in that world who could speak to it more thoughtfully, but if I were to guess, I think we are at the point in our world now where it is just undeniable that any kind of performance is going to be affected by our mental and emotional health. And if your entire livelihood and success depends on you being able to perform at a particular time, it's becoming more clear that you better be doing the work to support that ability on and off, you know, the court, so to speak. And I think that athletes have struggled for a really long time. But now that things are so public and connected through the internet and social media and all of that, maybe they're starting to see each other and be like, oh, you too? This is something that I'm not alone in. Because one thing that's really interesting about pretty much all mental health struggles is that they're kind of insidious and they're really good at convincing ourselves that we're the only one. Like, you can intellectually know you're probably not the only person who's ever felt this way. But there's a way, you know, if you talk to someone experiencing it, there's a way that you still do feel like you're completely alone and that no one could understand. And I'd guess that athletes are starting to look around and realize, oh, I'm not the only one. And all of this pressure and intensity is very intense, or, you know, is hard to deal with. And the proactive approach to fitness makes sense in an athletic world, right? You can't just get to your game and hope that your body performs. The same is true with our emotional health. You can't get to a high pressure situation and just hope that it's going to work out for you emotionally. You have to put in the reps. You have to work on your mental and emotional health and resilience such that you have the strength to draw on when you do need it. So that's a shot in the dark about what might be going on there, but it's been really amazing to see. And of course, athletes are just so, you know, they're held in such high regard in our society that when they start speaking up, you know, especially people who you think are just strong and have it all together and don't need help, when they start speaking up and saying, no, I do need help, then other people will listen.
Yeah, really. It really clearly means something. Something we glossed over that is very obvious that should have been discussed is, I'd love for you to talk about the transition from in-person to remote/online when it comes to therapy and these different mental fitness models. Because, and I guess I'll make this somewhat difficult and ask a question beforehand, because it's an interesting detail. You and your co-founder actually started with pop-ups. And pop-ups are just cool. So let's actually start with talking about pop-ups, like what you learned from that experience, and then how you've conceived of the space when it comes to remote versus in-person over the course of the past year and a half.
Sure. So my co-founder, Alexa Meyer, and I bonded years ago about the idea that we needed to be thinking about mental health more proactively. But just as you spoke to earlier, we weren't clear if the world was ready for that. It wasn't quite, you know, at that moment where everyone was ready for such a thing. So we decided to test the water with these pop-ups. So what we did was we'd rent out space at like a WeWork or at a company, whatever it might be. We did these in California, San Francisco, LA, New York, Vancouver, Toronto. We'd rent out space and we'd bring in really wonderful therapists for the day. And we would create private conference rooms. And when a person signed up, they were signing up for one free session with a therapist and a class with me or another leader about this idea of emotional fitness. And then we just set up the rest of the space like a community space. We'd put out reading or coloring books or whatever. And so people would to come try therapy and see what it was all about. What was really amazing to me about this was not only was the therapy matching really successful, 60% of people stayed with the therapist we matched them with after the pop-up, but also people were hanging out at these pop-ups for hours after their session. And when we asked them about that, they said, well, because I knew everyone was there for the same reason as me, it felt safe to build community. So it was really clear, okay, people want this. So they want to know that there are other people who are in a similar position and they want to lean into this kind of work. So the pop-ups really proved things out for us. So we raised money in 2019, and our first course of action was going to be to open an actual brick and mortar therapy gym. And we found our space and we were all set to do that. We always knew we also wanted digital offerings, but we were planning to start with in-person.
Where?
And
that was what city?
San Francisco was where the first one was going to be, with plans to go to New York shortly after. And COVID hit. And it became very clear very quickly that that wasn't going to work for the time. And so we did a quick pivot and we just switched the order of things. We just decided, okay, you know what? We're going to do our digital offering first, and we will circle back to the in-person option once that's really safe to do so. So I feel so conflicted about this kind of thing because telehealth does offer certain really interesting opportunities. You know, there are people who wouldn't be able to get to an office who now can have these services. There are people who feel more comfortable in their own space. There's the convenience factor. There's all kinds of things. But if I'm really honest with myself, I don't think digital connection is ever going to be as good. You know, it's something I've been quoted as saying is, I think text therapy is going to be as good as regular therapy whenever sexting is as good as actual sex. It's just not the same thing. It doesn't mean we shouldn't have it. But I think it's important to be really cautious about this idea that, you know, therapy is essentially about healing relationships to yourself and other people. And any kind of relationship is going to have a different flavor when you're with that person in the room. There's other things too, like, I don't want to fill my house with all of my pain and trauma. I want to go to someone's office, fill that room with it, and then leave and have it waiting for me when I get back to explore a little bit at a time every week. You know, it doesn't feel good to do that for my house personally. But if you ask some people, they like it better this way. And, you know, I can certainly respect differences of need. I just caution anyone to think that it's the same, because it's definitely not.
I like your frankness about, and the sexting metaphor, which is legitimately, it's both very funny, but also very useful to understand what you're saying. But I appreciate the frankness around what in-person can't do for digital. I guess my question then would be, how does that work from a startup perspective? Because there's a version of the story you could tell where, hey, it turns out that text is the perfect substitute and this is infinitely scalable and X, X, Y, and Z thing. So how do you think of when it comes to like actually building a startup and a company, the dynamic between brick and mortar and just the digital offerings, the balance that you have to actually have as a founder, as you're, you know, was once again, you took venture funding for this. How do you just think about the balance you have to have there?
It's a tough one. And I feel very committed and very strongly about clinical integrity and what we do. And, you know, I'm going to take off my founder hat for a second and just put on my therapist hat and tell you that I am very wary of most of the mental health companies out there. It's very scary to see what people are doing because it's faster and more scalable. And the problem with that is this isn't an app. It's people's health. It's people's minds. I think that, yeah, text therapy is probably going to be easier to scale, obviously, but it's not the same product. And I think my preference, and something I'm very grateful to be aligned with my co-founder about, is the idea that we are playing the long game. And we know that in the long run, the sometimes slower route is actually going to be more effective and get us to where we want to go. So we're struggling with that balance all the time. We still very much plan to and are excited to do in-person experiences. That's not possible right now. Like, most therapists don't feel ready to be in a small, unventilated room speaking for an hour with another person, understandably. And so that's not really in the cards for the immediate term. And at the same time, we still want to approximate real connection as much as we can. So for example, our classes are not like videos that you watch by yourself. They're live experiential classes where you're in breakout rooms, you're talking, you're face-to-face. We require video for most of our classes, and they're all facilitated by licensed therapists. So even though the classes aren't therapy, our belief is that a person who's been studying the human condition for 10 years or more is just going to be in a better position to help you work on these things and to keep the safe space. Because when we're talking about mental health, things can get away from us really quickly. And for a group to be safe, there needs to be someone making sure that it's contained in that way.
Yeah. So let's, as we're nearing the end here, let's get to the news you can use section.
Okay.
If I'm thinking of what the average listener is thinking about right now, they are seeing that the space you're in is very crowded. There's a lot of different things going on. I'm in New York City, so I will see 15 different ads for 15 different things on the subway. And yeah. To your point earlier, and this is where, once again, this is actually a huge value add in terms of the company you're building, because to your point, like you're an actual licensed professional in this space. This isn't something that you woke up and said, hey, this is a growth area. I don't know anything about it, but I'm just going to build there. It's actually a very important pitch for what the company is. But how do you suggest that listeners, beyond just obviously checking out Koa, how do you suggest they just think about this, right? Because I think people kind of intuitively can understand, hey, like, I can't just think that text therapy is going to do everything for me. But how should they just approach a crowded space where the stakes are high? This isn't, you know, hair loss, or this isn't, these aren't one of these like D2C spaces where it's very crowded, but ultimately it doesn't really matter like where your Allbirds knockoffs come from. Like, this is mental health, so it really matters. So how do you suggest people think about it?
You know, I have strong opinions about this kind of thing. I do want to firstly recognize that different things work for different people. I do know people who are like, hey, text therapy is for me because it's really hard for me to show up in person for X, Y, or Z reasons, you know? So part of it is giving yourself permission to try a bunch of different things and to feel into what works well for you. But to me, think about the integrity of the product you're using. You know, if what you're working on is your mental health, I would recommend that you do it with a mental health professional. There are a lot of companies out there that are trying to help people with their mental health, and none of the services are actually being provided by licensed professionals. So that's one thing that I personally, from my biased perspective, would recommend. And then the next thing I think is having it be okay if the first couple things you try don't work for you. I know a lot of people who tried therapy once 10 years ago and had a bad experience, and then they're like, oh, I guess therapy is not right for me. But just to use another sex metaphor for you, that's a little bit like, you know, going on one bad date and swearing off sex for the rest of your life. Like, you do have to try things a couple times in a different ways and try different things. Like, meditation works well for some people. Journaling works well for some people. Group therapy versus individual therapy, that kind of thing. Try many things. The other thing that's tough is, I think if you talk to any kind of health professional, whether it's a physician or a therapist or whatever, you'll hear a similar thing about, I wouldn't recommend just like Googling something and hoping that the thing at the top of the search results is the right thing for you. I really recommend referrals. Find people who are loving their experience, who are feeling truly supported, who are making progress, who seem to be growing in the way you'd want to grow, and ask them what they're doing and, you know, who they're seeing and how they might support you in starting your own journey. Because a lot of people get into this profession for the wrong reasons or aren't totally equipped to do the work. And, you know, we have to be discerning. And, you know, it's a big thing to put in another person's hands.
So the two last big questions. Question one would be, and this goes back to your really good and useful answer around privilege, what work is still to be done around advancing acceptance and just accessibility to not just the services that you're working on at Koa, but just like the idea of like mental fitness? Because as you said in your answer, I could work it on deck and have absolutely no problem with saying, hey, like, not only do I need to work on my mental fitness, I need to take a break for a week because I'm doing too many podcasts. That's entirely doable. But there could be people like in the service industry, people who are essential workers who aren't going to have that. So what work still needs to be done on that end of the conversation?
Holy shit, there's so much work that needs to be done. My gosh. I feel like if anything, right now we're almost creating problems as we're working to fix problems. Now, a big issue in this field is that it's expensive to get quality care. And I think there are companies that are trying to solve that problem by paying therapists less and reducing prices in ways that I don't actually think serve society. you know, the reason therapists charge as much as we do is that it's extremely expensive to become a therapist. Most of us graduate with tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. And in order to pay that back, we do have to charge a particular wage. So when you charge less, you know, these services where you're paying $25 for a therapy session, you're getting what you pay for. You're not getting quality care. So what I think really needs to be done is a complete overhaul in what it looks like to become trained to do this work. I think that therapists should be able to learn how to do this for free or for cheap, the way, you know, it's done in many other countries, so that when you graduate, you can serve the people you really got into this work to serve. You know, most of us didn't say, you know what, I can't wait to only work with really rich techies. No, like we really want to work with people who need our support the most, but it's not always possible because of debt. So that's a big part of it. The second thing is insurance companies big time need to understand the importance of covering this. And that's one of the things we're trying to prove out with COA, is that when you do work on your mental and emotional health in a proactive way, you actually end up saving a lot of money down the line, just like insurance companies are starting to realize that if they incentivize proactive physical health, it actually helps their bottom line because people are less likely to get sick and need the money to fix it later. I really need that to happen with mental health. It should be covered. It should be a basic human right. Like no one gets through life without trauma and without needing some support. So that should just, I think, be a given. So there's just so much. And then of course there's the stigma of it just being okay to need this and to know where to get it and to not have to go through it alone.
Actually, that's a useful point that I noted when I introduced you as Dr. Emily Anhalt. How do you actually become a licensed therapist? What does that process, to your point about it costing hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? What does that process look like?
Well, it can look like different things. If you get a master's level degree, it's, you know, 3 years of school followed by, you know, a couple years of getting your hours, that kind of thing. If you have a doctorate level degree, it can take 10 years easily of not getting paid while you work to do it. So I did a program where you get your master's along the way and you get your doctorate at the end. And what I liked about my program is that I started seeing patients my first year. So I went to grad school and literally in my first month of grad school, not knowing what I was doing at all, I started seeing patients. Now, what was tough was I was seeing people who had intense, overwhelming trauma, because those were people who couldn't afford licensed clinicians. And so we were working with them under supervision to learn how to do what we were doing. That's problematic for all kinds of reasons, but I was grateful to get to start the work right away. So I had 4 years of classes, and then I had to get 1,500 pre-doc hours and then 1,500 post-doc hours and then sitting for your licensure. So all in all, from start to finish, it took me 9 years to get my license. And I'm glad that it took that long. I really learned how to do the work. And I think if you rush through it too quickly, sometimes you don't have the tools that you need. But I came out of it $250,000 in debt. And so I had to really think about what that meant in terms of the populations I served. Had I come out of it with no debt, I can imagine I would have spent a lot more time working with communities that need the work on a whole different level. So I think it's a system overhaul that needs to happen.
You spoke a little bit about your longer term vision, but to wrap everything up, like what, how, ideally, how do you want the next 2 years, to your point about growing the right way as opposed to hyper growth the wrong way, how do you see the next 2 years playing out ideally?
Our North Star has always been how to get more people in rooms, whether they're virtual or real rooms, together working on themselves. So I think the three things that really distinguish us as a company are our proactive approach versus a reactive approach, being community-based, and our clinical integrity. The feeling that, you know, we really, really work hard to do things the right way. Like an example of this is, you know, within our company, everyone legally could have access to patient information because we're an organization and we're not providing the therapy and all kinds of things. But I believe that confidentiality and privacy are so important, and everyone at the company agrees, such that no one has access to the patient information unless that is their explicit job. And we just really try to live all of the values within our company that we're asking of people outside the company. So the seven traits are also our seven cultural values. You know, we're all encouraged to work on ourselves. There's a therapy stipend each year, that kind of thing. So, you know, we try to be really meta. We try to practice as much as we can what we're trying to make change outside of the company. And so in the next 5 years, I hope that this starts to really trickle and seep out, and that more and more people in organizations and systems decide that it's worth it to invest in this kind of work and that they have the support they need to do it.
I lied when I said last question, because you said something very helpful and interesting. Okay. How should prospective patients think about the privacy aspect that you just alluded to? So for example, if I'm signing up for anything, I do now, but I wouldn't have the foresight to think about, I guess technically speaking, legally, everyone has access to this. How should they think about the privacy landscape when it comes to these types of services?
The privacy landscape in general is so confusing and complicated, you know what I mean? That all I can say is I believe the confidentiality is really important when it comes to mental health. And that's not because no one should know our business. It's because we hide things from ourselves too. And if we worry that revealing that to ourselves would also mean revealing it to the world, then it might not bubble up at all. You know, I mean, ask someone who's ever tried to do therapy when they know that their partner is one room over. Even if they're not talking about their partner that day, it doesn't feel the same. You need to know that you can reveal things to yourself and then decide whether you want those things shared in order to get to the really deep, good stuff. And that's why I think privacy and confidentiality are so important. In terms of like what it means when it hits the internet, I can't even begin to wrap my mind around it. I mean, we've seen articles and stuff come out about patient data and, you know, who has access to that and what is done with that. And it's terrifying to me. The way that we mitigate that is we only work with people who are as committed to the integrity as we are. And we try to weave those values into everything that we do. We try to be really open to check each other when things don't feel right. And, you know, I'd recommend that you are just thoughtful and know that you deserve to be the decider of who knows what's going on in your internal world and when.
Really well said. Thank you so much for explaining what you're building, but also how people should think about this, wearing both of those two hats at the same time. Do you have anything that our listeners should take a look at beyond obviously just the COA website or any other resources?
Definitely check out COA for sure. Join COA.com, JOINCOA. Come take a class. They're better experienced than explained. I think they're really special, and I'd love to see people there. And if you want to connect with me, Twitter is the best way. I tweet almost every day. My handle is Dr. Emily Anhalt. I'd love to see you on there. If you work for a company and you'd like to bring more mental health and emotional fitness into that company, we'd love to support with that. But mostly go find your people, like find people who think that you're great exactly the way you are. That's the best way to feel motivated to change, in my experience. So I'd encourage any kind of community people can find and lean into.
Well, Dr. Anhalt, thank you for joining us in the Deep End.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us in the Deep End. If you enjoyed your stay, give us a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with your friends and colleagues to help grow the show with us. We've also got show notes and more episodes available at ideas.beyonddeck.com. See you next time.